Good morning, welcome to the Full Tottenham Breakfast on SoundOut Radio 102.5 FM with me, Peter Shearn. It is the 23rd of September. It's the last but one show that I'll be hosting. The show next week will be hosted from then on, for at least the time being, by the wonderful Julie Mullen, and it's going to shake the whole thing up. It's going to be a different thing altogether, but it will be at 8 o'clock next week, so do tune in, find out what occurs. Very exciting stuff. In the meantime, I'll be going to have a bit of a break from it all, so thank you everyone for listening to the show up to this point, and hopefully you will stay with the new version, which I have high hopes for, and also maybe involved with in some way, shape or form, helping out. Okay, today though, the weather. Oh no, I've forgotten to mention, outrageous of me, that today on the show we have Ed Deacon, and he's going to be talking about the Van Dijk Club in Plymouth. Now, a lot of local people will know about the Van Dijk Club. I don't know anything about it, so I'm coming to this from afresh, but he's brought along a lot of tunes that relate to the period of his knowledge of the Van Dijk Club, and they're great. It's good stuff. If you like your late 70s, early 80s music, then stay tuned, because there's some great tunes coming up from that period, which we'll be talking about directly after we've heard my favourite ever song, believe it or not, May You Never by John Martin.
May you never lay your head down without a hand to hold. May you never make your bed out in the cold. Just like a never leave.
one of my favourite tracks of all time. That was May You Never by John Martin. And that was chosen by Ed Deacon, who's here with us this morning. Good morning, Ed.
Good morning.
Thank you for joining us on the show. And we're going to be talking about the Van Dyke Club. Now, why are we talking about the Van Dyke Club? What is your connection with this?
I was approached by someone who was writing a book on the club. The Van Dyke organisation had run gigs in Plymouth between 1968 and 1980, initially at their own club, but later on, at the time I was going to see music, down at Plymouth Guildhall and in various local nightclubs.
Right. Are you a Plymouth boy?
I'm a Plymouth boy, yeah.
I did
get to Totnes as soon as I could.
When did you get to Totnes, just out of interest?
It's about 24 years ago now.
Ah, right. So you're nearly, you're getting close to being a Totnesian then.
It's possible.
Let's do, in fact, as soon as this program's finished, I'll get onto Facebook and I'll put, who's a real Totnesian here? Let's get that one going again, yeah. Okay, so you were into your music at the time, so you've been to see... You were an aficionado of live music at the time, are you?
I was, and we were spoiled for choice because the for a medium sized town way down in the southwest, the Van Dyke organisation would book in people who'd go on to be a sort of mainstay of music in the next sort of couple of decades. So you got to see all sorts of things.
So they seem to be on the cutting edge of finding like an A&R group. They seem they have become quite well known as being the first ones to put on events by very big bands that came out.
Yeah, I think initially because of the fact they have their own club, they could afford to take a chance with people. And that attitude sort of stayed with them as they expanded into bigger gigs at Plymouth Guildhall, which would hold, I guess, between 900 and 1,200 people. I don't think they could be quite as inventive because they'd obviously got to pay for the hire of the hall.
Right.
But
so it gave them the freedom to do these things. And in fact, I've just done a little search on Tinternet for just images, and this is remarkable. I've got an image here, and hilariously, after a conversation with your wife, it's on the Barclay James Harvest website. And she'll like that, I'm sure. But here we are. Here's a listing from, I don't know what year this is, because, of course, on a poster, they wouldn't have put the year. But this is Saturday, 26th of July, Marsha Hunt and White Trash. Friday, the 1st of August, Pink Floyd. 2nd of August, Killing Floor. 7th of August, Moody Blues. 8th of August, Barclay James Harvest. 9, Principal Edwards Magic Theatre. Then we've got Duster Bennett, Heaven, Liverpool Scene, and then Friday 29th, John Martin and the Famous Jug Band. So it's, and also Mike Westbrook Concert Band. And Friday the 19th, Yes, only one of the biggest bands ever to have been. So that's quite something, isn't it? That's quite a lineup for August and September, isn't it?
It really is, and that's got to have been, I guess, the late 60s, particularly with the Pink Floyd there.
Yeah, or early 70s. But
you think of what you'd pay to see them now if they were still going. It's incredible.
Yeah.
But yeah, the Van Dyke organisation just had good taste and good contacts, and I think started to get approached by some of the booking agencies who wanted their acts to appear in a wider audience. I mean, there weren't that many places you could play. Most of the gigs that were being put on in those days were generally in universities, polytechnics, teacher training colleges. So to have a sort of club or club-like atmosphere was unusual.
Yeah, and it's everybody's got to start somewhere. So it's not that a lot of people sort of think, I can't believe that even happened. But every band starts somewhere, don't they? So that would have been probably with Syd Barrett when they were doing that. But I'm just searching again, having another look here. Here's another one. If I can get it big, I'll be able to look at it properly. So view image. Right. Friday 23rd 23rd of January, Quatermass. 24th of January, Tyrannosaurus Rex. Blondel, Man, Quintessence, Yes Again on the 27th, and Fairport Convention. So, yeah, I think it's sort of synonymous with the Marquee Club, isn't it? About the same time, I guess.
Yeah, I guess it is. I think one of the more interesting things is that they weren't too Catholic about their tastes in music. So you'd got the sort of rise of prog rock, but there were also a lot of sort of folk acts coming through, like John Martin, like Lindisfarne, like Steel Ice Band. And as in the sort of early 70s, you got things like glam coming along, you started to see bands like Gary Glitter, Susie Quattro, and then Queen. I mean, in 1974, you could have seen Queen at the Guildhall for 80p.
Yes, I do remember those times when tickets were not expensive. And the idea, I think, back then, and that's turned round, hasn't it? The style of the way touring works. The tour is now the way that bands make money, because they charge for people to go in and they sell merchandise. But back then, it was to promote albums that they've made, and they would make their money through the sales in the record shops, and quite a bit probably from the merchandising table, I would imagine.
Yeah, I think a lot of bands owe their continued existence to the rise of the band T-shirt rather than the strength of their musical output.
Mm.
It's different times these days when you're paying sort of three figures for a ticket to see an act. An act that's probably 200 yards away and could be anyone. The thing about a lot of these gigs were even the bigger ones, you could see who was up there. There was no video screen. It was you were in the room with the people, and there was a real atmosphere.
Yeah, that is. I haven't been to many big events, properly big ones. I've been to festivals and things, but it's that disconnect. I mean, it's amazing to be amongst a lot of people, but a small space with a well-formed, good band, is that's where the magic really happens, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. That's a real joy when you get those nights. They stay with you for a long time.
Yes, and John Martin, why did you pick him out?
Always a favourite of mine, and a lot of the bands who sort of came through, particularly the acoustic performers, were a bit one dimensional. You know, they were wild and winsome folkies, whereas John Martin could go from being your average folky to being a sort of one-man version of the Pink Floyd with all his electronic echo equipment and stuff like that. And there was just nothing else that sounded like him. I mean, you think these days when you can take on the whole of Glastonbury with an acoustic guitar and a looping pedal, like Mr. Sheeran did, you go back to John Martin, and he was like an early version of that with all these weird tape loops and tape delays and things.
Yes, he really did kick it out there. I mean, having watched a few videos, I never actually managed to get to see him. I did try, but I failed. He was quite something. It's worth looking at YouTube videos of him playing live back from those days, because the sound he created was astonishing.
He was amazing. I don't think anyone else has ever been able to reproduce it. And I know there are quite a few people out there who tried, because it was just so distinctive.
Mm. Yeah, definitely. Go on, sorry.
A great songwriter as well. I mean, as you said, May You Never is just such a great song.
Yeah. Well, mostly based in folk, isn't it? I mean, that is his roots.
Yeah.
And so he was, you know, much as he went crazy with the electronics, he was he was still a folky.
Yes, he was.
Yeah. And then Eddie and the Hot Rods, we've got a song from them. Now, I suppose it's to do with the time, but this is a great little track, Do Anything You Want to Do. Why have you picked that one out?
It's the one they're remembered for, but for me, 1975 was the year when stuff started to change. And I think I saw the Hot Rods in late 75 supporting the Kersal Flyers, who were from Southend. And the Hot Rods were my age playing really high energy music, and I'd never seen anything like that. The attitude at a lot of the gigs I went to was you sat on the floor and musicians played for you. And the Hot Rods were, I think the words young, loud and snotty comes to mind. But
Do Anything You Want to Do by Eddie and the Hot Rods. I'm talking over a very loud, long, long fade out there. But there we go. Yeah, so they were the beginning of punk, you say?
Yeah, when I saw the Hot Rods, it was the first time I'd seen a bunch of guys my age playing songs that meant something for me. And I think there was a fundamental change in the what you expected when you went to see a band. Whereas before you'd gone to see a band, sat on the floor and they played for you. The thing with the Hot Rods is that they were they were coming from the youth, they were coming from the street, and the sounds reflected that. And I think the Do Anything You Want to Do is just such a great song. I mean, I've got such great memories of that playing through the summer of 77.
Yeah.
And they were a great live band. I saw them many times. One of the weirdest ones and one of the best times I ever saw them was playing in the bar of the Wharf Art Centre in Tavistock. And there'd been some problem with the PA. The PA hadn't turned up, so they couldn't play in the main hall. So they did the gig in the bar. And it was like a bomb going off. They were tremendous.
Oh, wow. That's proper sort of musical history kind of things. So I bet if you spoke to them directly, they would remember that event themselves.
Yeah, it was like, we'll do the song, we'll do the gig right here in front of you.
Yes, I did hear a story. I don't know if it's true. I've got one story about Genesis going to Scotland, and they did a tour of Scotland, and there were some really out there places they went to, and they went to one place where there were as many people in the band as there was in the audience. And they actually decamped and decided to just go to the bar and all have a drink together. Apparently. I don't think they even did the gig. I'm not sure, but there you go. They say you should always carry on and just do it. Just skimming through these images for the Van Dyke Club, which is great fun, actually. Again, here we go. We got Yes again. They played there a lot. They played there a great deal. So I suppose Plymouth was kind of the furthest point south, I guess. Maybe Truro would be the next point on from there, would it?
Yeah, I mean, you'd occasionally see gigs advertised at the Winter Gardens in Penzance. But generally, a lot of the bands would come as far as Plymouth, and that was it. The big bands, I mean, even to this day, bands, really big bands, don't tend to play south of Bristol.
Which is
a pain. But in those days, they'd go a little bit further.
Yeah, and of course, the roads weren't motorways back then. So a lot of getting down the A30 to do a gig would actually be quite a trek, yeah. Wouldn't it?
Yeah, and I think, you know, a lot of these bands were never the most organised. You know, if you had a gig in Birmingham followed by a gig in Penzance, that was a marathon undertaking just to get there.
Yeah, absolutely. So the Van Dykes, they're a family, aren't they?
Yeah, the guy who started it was Peter, but his son Greg, as he got further into the 70s, Greg seemed to take over a lot of the organisation and booking.
Right.
And again, I think from his dad, he'd got a feel for what was up and coming, because you start getting into the days of punk. And I mean, they booked the Pistols, but they booked them in the middle of 76. I went to see them, and they didn't turn up. Johnny had the flu, which is not very rock and roll.
Poor Johnny.
But then there would have been about 30 of us there. They were unheard of. But I think in those days, you'd got the music press was really big. I mean, New Musical Express used to sell, I think, 300,000 copies a week. Mm. You got other magazines like Melody Maker and Sounds.
Yeah.
So the good thing about Plymouth in those days was that you could read about a band in the paper one week, and you could pretty much assume that within 6 to 8 weeks, you might actually get to see them live.
Yes.
Which was great.
And it was a smaller world then, wasn't it? There's the idea of a band at that time playing, I don't know, Wembley would be unthinkable. They wouldn't be able to, they would get close to filling it up.
Yeah, I mean, there were very few bands who could do it. I guess the Stones and possibly the Who, but the logistics of doing big gigs like that hadn't really been settled, because, again, as we said earlier, you were paying so little to see them. And the prospect of being charged tens of pounds to go to a gig, no one was going to pay it in those days. Whereas these days, it's taken as read. You get the big show, you get the lights, you get the video screens. and it's a different experience.
Different, yeah, it is. In fact, I think I paid £1 to see Peter Gabriel in Bath. I think it was like that. just after he left Genesis, but that was the 80s. That was quite, late 70s. It was just, yeah. You know, quite, it's interesting how the live music scene has changed so much, because big bands, or not even big bands, the actual hassle of touring seems so much harder now than it would have been then. It was sort of given as read that you did a tour, you produce records, you did a tour. Nowadays, with the onset of the internet and how records are no longer the thing, it's changed the way we see bands now, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it has. And a lot of people these days are basically doing it themselves, because you can make your album on an iPad, you can sell it via the internet, you don't need a big record company behind you. But back in the 70s and 80s, the record companies were basically the gatekeepers of what was going to get onto vinyl and appear in your local record shop.
Yeah, we were sort of fed this music to some extent. The reality, the realization, or maybe not that many people participated in trying to have a band. I'm sure there were lots, but by comparison with today's world, I would say there are more musicians now than there ever were in the past.
Yeah, and I think the punk ethos was very much do it yourself, and you've got these little record companies like Stiff Records popping up, who would quite happily take a band, put out one single, and never do anything with them again, and they'd sink or swim based on that. But it was, you know, turn it over quickly, keep the costs low. And there were some, you know, some acts came and went in an instant, like Mayflies, but others stuck around. I mean, one of my favourite memories of the time is of seeing Elvis Costello playing with the Attractions. And
yeah, go on.
Yeah, and they basically, I think the first album had been done without the band. They'd been rehearsing. They'd recruited a band to actually tour the album. And they'd been rehearsing in Cornwall for 6 months. They went out and did a couple of gigs, and they played in Plymouth. And they must have played most of the contents of the first three albums, which was amazing. If you went back in time and saw it today, you'd think you were watching a tribute band, because every song they did was later a hit. It's tremendous.
Elvis Costello, I saw him in Bristol quite late on, not during his early days. And I was genuinely astonished by the amount of hits he's had. And he was playing hit after hit. And it was like a greatest hits show. And I think he must have played 20 songs that evening. And they were all massive, stonking hits. I'd never really associated him with being a hit maker.
Yeah, I mean, the man was a human jukebox that night. It was incredible. But yeah, he's written some great stuff.
Think it's an appropriate time to have a bit of peace, love and understanding, do you think?
I think it is.
so funny about peace, love and understanding, as chosen by Ed Deacon, who is with us here this morning, talking about the Van Dyke Club. And so you were, yeah, you gave it away a little bit there to me, that when you saw Elvis Costello, you actually went out and had a drink afterwards with him.
We got to go drinking with Elvis after. It was a bit of a strange night all round, because at the time we saw him, he'd had, I think, one, maybe two singles out, which had not been particularly well received. He'd certainly not made huge amounts of money out of them. And he recorded his first album with an American band and needed to go out on the road and tour it. So they recruited a touring band from the cream of the London pub rock mafia. And they spent 6 weeks rehearsing down in a house on the edge of Bodmin Moor. And they wanted to do a couple of gigs just to see how it was going. And they played their first gig ever as Elvis Costello and the Attractions the night before at, I believe, David Stowe Village Hall.
Okay.
And they played the second night at Woods Club in Plymouth. And it was sort of posted at very short notice. We thought, oh, yeah, I've heard the singles. We'll go along. And I'm walking up the stairs to go into the club, and there's someone I vaguely recognise sitting at the top of the stairs. And it's Captain Sensible, the guitar player from the band.
Right.
And a conversation ensued. And he'd been on a surfing holiday in Bude, saw they were playing, and just come along to support his fellow label mates.
Okay.
But the band themselves were tremendous. They played stuff from the first two albums. And it was an amazing night. And after, we met Elvis at the bar and got talking. And he was a great guy. And I think we spent quite a few hours after they'd actually finished their set just chatting to the band.
Hmm.
And it was obvious then they were going to go on and do really great things. And
yeah,
it's probably one of the best gigs I ever saw at that time in my life down in Plymouth.
Right, because I think he had a bit of a reputation for being a bit vicious on stage kind of thing, but I think it was front, because having seen him since, he's immensely affable.
So, yeah, I think he put on the persona to basically the music. I think he was actually quite a sort of shy sort of guy.
Yeah,
but,
yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah, so quite a remarkable thing. And he's on Stiff Records, and as I understand it, Stiff Records was basically a bunch of people in a terraced house below with a shed with some recording gear in, and Nick Lowe constantly producing loads and loads of albums for all, or songs or singles for all the label mates on Stiff Records, as far as I understand it.
Yeah, I think Nick Lowe really made his name as a producer. I mean, he'd been a bass player with Brinsley Schwartz, I think, who again came out of the pub rock scene in London.
Mm.
But he became a very talented producer, known for getting stuff done really quickly, which earned him the nickname Basher. His words were, "Let's bash this down, we can sort it out later." So Basher Lowe was the house producer for Stiff Records, and they knocked out all manner of different stuff.
Mm. Sort of like a British wrecking crew.
Yeah, I guess so, in a way. No, nothing like as talented musically, but they had skills of their own. Although, of course, Nick Lowe did go on to do greater things, and at one point had Johnny Cash as his father-in-law, which must have been quite intimidating.
Oh, wow, did he? I didn't realise he married Johnny Cash's daughter.
He married one of the Carter daughters, and I forget, it might have been Carlene, I'm trying to remember now, but yeah.
And so, The Only Ones, we got a track from them. Why them?
They were a great band. I think, in my opinion, 1978 is probably one of the best years that has ever been for music. And you look at the people who emerged at that time, and you've got Elvis Costello, you've got great bands like Squeeze, you've got The Jam, you've got people who went on to have quite long, sustained careers.
Mm.
You know, the punk had sort of whittled out the wannabes from the people who actually had genuine talent, and well, you could get by with a single on very little musical talent. if you were a band, for example, like Squeeze or like the Only Ones, who had people who could play and write really good songs,
you were
set fair for a good career. So the Only Ones came from South London, did a phenomenally good album in the early 70s, and played in Plymouth a couple of times. And I actually saw them in Totnes. I came up to Totnes, they played at the Civic Hall. That would have been probably about 79 or 80.
Right.
In the days when they were putting bands on in the Civic Hall.
The Civic Hall, that needs to be reopened and redone properly, everybody involved. Come on, get your act together.
Wouldn't that be great? Yeah. I mean, there's some great music out there, and I think Totnes is really lucky in having quite a vibrant live music scene.
We certainly yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
So the
Only Ones, anyway, tremendous singer with a very distinctive voice, brilliant guitar player, and this is one of the quintessentially great singles from the sort of late 70s.
Sudden finish there from the Only Ones. Very distinctive singing going on there as well. That like you say, if you said the Only Ones to people, they probably wouldn't recognize the name of the band, but they certainly recognize that track, wouldn't they?
It's a great song, and it's been used behind a number of commercials and things, so I think that's what's paying for their retirement these days.
Yes, of course. If A&R, is it A&R PRS payments, they're not so big nowadays unless you get in a commercial.
No.
So probably a good move to get into commercials. So this all stems from you knowing the writer of a book about the Van Dyke. Is that right?
About 4 years ago, a chap called Jonathan Hill, who was a Van Dyke regular, put together a book on the club. and it collected interviews with former punters and various bits of ephemera.
Right.
And it attracted quite a lot of attention in Plymouth, and a lot of other stuff started to emerge. And I was put in touch with Jonathan because one of my friends had taped the Sex Pistols Plymouth gig on the Anarchy tour, and we'd still got the tape. Brian, the chap who actually made the tape, had died from multiple sclerosis about 10 years before. But he was interested in the tape. So we had the tape transcribed, and a friend of ours, another local musician called Rob Congdon, basically did a tape transcription of what went on, because we got pretty much the whole gig. And what's as interesting is the music, is the comments you can hear in the background.
Right.
So one of the things that sort of came back to haunt me is I can be heard commenting that they're not actually that much different to AC/DC, who I'd seen a few weeks previously.
Really?
Which sounds a tad strange, but very, very riff-driven and stuff like that.
Yes.
But anyway, Jonathan Hill wrote a second book on the bands that had played Plymouth between sort of 72, when the Van Dyke Club closed, and 1980, when he basically came out of music promotion. And again, it's an amazing list of bands who played in various clubs and things in Plymouth. I was in conversation with Jonathan about the Pistols gig and the tape. I mentioned that I got some photos gathering dust, because for a few years I used to take cameras to the odd gig, and wondered if they'd be of interest to him in the book. And lo and behold, he printed over 20 of them, which I couldn't believe how well they came out, because I'm by no means a good photographer. And I got some great photos of bands like, again, Eddie and the Hot Rods, the Stranglers and the Damned, which feature in the book.
Right.
So that's my link to the book. Can I give the man a plug as well? Because it is, interested in local music, it is it's a great book. It's called Van Dyke, Life and Times of the Plymouth Club, 1968 to 1980. It's by Jonathan Hill. It's published by the author. But if you Google Van Dyke book, you can probably find a link to it somewhere, or failing that, I think you can probably get it on eBay.
We'll put a link on it on the podcast, which if you're listening to the podcast, it's down below. So have a look and click that link to see more about it. The interesting thing, if you are searching, is Van Dyke is spelled D-I-K-E, not D-Y-K-E, which is an easy mistake, one I made for a while. You were saying about the Sex Pistols. So you've heard you got the whole tape of it when you were there.
Yeah. And it was very much of its time. Yeah. It was interesting. Only a few days previously, of course, they'd been on primetime TV in London. And
The swearing
outraged,
thing.
Outraged the public. I remember the headlines in I think it was the Mirror, the filth and the fury and stuff like this. And they've gone from being a relatively unknown band to front page news, headline news. But of course, they'd attracted the sort of notoriety that you don't want. And all of a sudden, what had been a fairly extensive tour of the UK that had been planned for the end of 1976, suddenly started to shrink in size, because lots of local councils basically wouldn't allow the gigs to take place.
Right, because of the fear and rage that seemed to be inflicted upon the characters involved. But it's, I've heard from another local here who saw the Sex Pistols that they weren't very good. But that didn't really matter. It was all about that was when marketing was really important, or became important.
Yeah, that's it. I mean, on the list that night, you've got the Clash, who started it. And I remember at the time thinking they were really shambolic, but actually listening to it again, that they were just incredibly fast. But they were actually relatively competent. The next band up was Johnny Thunder's Heartbreakers from New York, who were quite a long established band, and they were, I guess, there was a touch of glam, a bit like the New York Dolls, who of course Thunders had played with. Right. And they were really good for me. They were probably the best band of the night. And the Pistols, well, the Pistols were the Pistols. Johnny was vaguely insulting to the audience. A lot of people were there basically just to, I guess, to see the elephant, basically. It's like, yeah, we've heard all about this bunch. What are they like?
Yeah.
So it was a packed gig. Musically, you didn't think you were seeing anything that was radically new, but it was basically in the outlook and the fact they'd tormented Bill Grundy on TV.
Yes. We have run out of time, Ed. Thank you so much, Ed Deacon, for being on the show today. Before you go, though, tell us about, because this person I don't recognise, Daryl Scott.
Daryl Scott. Daryl Scott is an oddball that I threw in there at the end. He's got no real connection with any of the stuff that went before, but there's a link back to John Martin, because the guy playing bass on this album is Danny Thompson,
yes,
who came originally from Tynmouth and is still playing and making records, probably well into his 80s. But Daryl's an American singer-songwriter, writes brilliant songs, put out this album last year, which is a collection of all things Hank Williams songs, but a great, great songwriter, got a great, great band with him. People who've played with, I guess, people like Robert Plant and a lot of other sort of world music type people.
Well,
great band. Great.
Fantastic.
Great.
Well, you've been listening to the full Totnes Breakfast on Sandar Radio 102.5 FM. I've got to thank Ed Deacon again for joining us this morning. And this is Daryl Scott and the Blues Come Around.
Oh, the blues.